This is The Source from Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davis. Today, the history of psychedelic music. This is The Electric Prunes, 1966, Too Much to Dream Last Night.
Last night your shadow fell upon my lovely room. I touched your golden hair and tasted your perfume. Your eyes were filled with love the way they used to be. Your gentle hand reached out to comfort me.
Psychedelic rock is a style of music that rose in the late 1960s. It's associated with the hippie counterculture. It was the precursor to electronic music, heavy metal, and progressive rock, and contained the contradictory elements of political protest and escapism. William Eckert writes about it in his book, Psychedelic Popular Music, A History Through Musical Topic Theory. Eckert is a professor of music at Carleton University, Ottawa. I asked him, what is psychedelic rock?
It's experimental. It draws from a lot of other different kinds of music, more so than other sorts of pop music do, I guess. It usually has some kind of connection to ideas of consciousness expansion or maybe to drug culture. But there's a lot of different types, right? I mean, there's psychedelic funk, there's psychedelic folk, there's the newer electronic dance musics. There's, most people think of the psychedelic rock when they first think about psychedelic music. So there's things they all have in common, but there's also really interesting differences between them, too.
It seems like psychedelic music was a deliberate attempt to reject some of the standard music forms at the time, that there was this cultural movement. It was part of this countercultural...
It came along in the mid-60s when there was a lot of experimentation going on anyway, right? So the counterculture is one source of that. It also picked up a lot from experimental classical music, you know, the way the Beatles and people like that picked up on Stockhausen and some of the experimental electronic music. The 50s and 60s was a time in music when people were experimenting a lot in general. There were a lot of experiments going on in jazz. So it was a really good time for something like psychedelic subcultures to show up and just take an interest in that sort of thing.
But when you say psychedelic, people, it's not just about music, but it's also, people think about the use of the narcotics. And then it was indicative of an art style and fashion. It was a movement.
Yeah, it was a movement in general. You know, there was visual design, there was fashion, there was movies, there was all sorts of elements all happening at the same time.
So when did psychedelic music begin to show itself in the popular culture? When did that start to develop?
Well, I would say that the earliest thing that was really distinctively psychedelic was ragga rock, right? Which wasn't just psychedelic, but a lot of things like See My Friends by the Kinks. Ragga rock was its own thing, but it was also the point where I think people began to make the connection to the psychedelic culture as a sound of music that was specific to that.
So raga is part of Indian music. And so
yeah, well, raga in Indian music refers more to the use of what we would think of as modal approach to scales and melody. So a raga is a scale, basically, but then it's also a long improvisation, a melodic improvisation based around that scale. So Raga Rock, when people started to talk about that, a lot of what they were thinking of was the way that people would start to use sitars or guitars to make that sort of Indian melodic sound. And the beginning of Heart Full of Soul is one of the really classic examples of that.
Sacred heart of lonely, deep in dark despair.
That opening riff is, you know, one of the real staple moments in Raga Rock, and Raga Rock was one of those, you know, because the raga sound and the Indian thing was so central to psychedelic culture, people really started to make that connection at that time.
The Beatles also were a main provider of the cultural change, or making psychedelic music and bringing it into the mainstream. Is that true?
Uh-huh. They were certainly really important, yeah. I mean, I think sometimes people overstate their importance. Like, the Beatles were crucial for always, you know, doing the definitive version of things people really noticed. I mean, they brought it all together on Sgt. Pepper, but even before that, on track, you know, even singles like Rain or the Revolver album. But a lot of what they were doing was popularizing things that other people were into, right? I mean, the Yardbirds and the Kinks were just as important for Raga Rock, for example. And, you know, the Beach Boys were just as important for some of the real symphonic pop aspects. But the Beatles had a real talent for, you know, packaging it all and popularizing it, spreading it to a more of a mass audience.
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. It is not dying.
When did they start calling this psychedelic music?
That's a really interesting question, you know? I mean, the word psychedelic wasn't coined until 1956. In terms of psychedelic music, I haven't seen research into specifically, but it would have been sometime probably in either late 1964 or early 1965, somewhere in there. You know, the psychedelic subcultures in London and San Francisco other places were starting to pop up around 64, 65. So somewhere in there would have been the first time.
But at that time, it would have been more part of the avant-garde scene.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. Like I was saying, a lot of it, you know, would have gone by other terms like raga rock or even a lot of garage rock, you know, which we would think of as psychedelic. At the time, people would have thought of more just as garage rock or, you know, use other terms.
So is that where we can talk about the 13th floor elevators?
You're gonna look around in your mind forever.
So the 13th floor elevators, not coming from one of these major psychedelic scene places like San Francisco or London, but coming from Austin, Texas.
Right.
And having a mix of the garage rock sound, but also having being dark and also being very kind of overt about drug use. So that made them gave them a special position as a psychedelic band.
Yeah, very much so.
I guess we should listen to some 13th floor elevators. So the 13th floor elevators, Rocky Erickson and the 13th floor elevators, what role did they play in creating a scene of and a popular hunger or some sort of, you know, demand for this type of music?
I mean, my impression was that they kind of held up the underground banner. You know, I mean, they, like you said, Austin wasn't one of the leading scenes like San Francisco or London. The band had a troubled history for all kinds of various reasons. So, you know, they never commercially consolidated the way the other psychedelic bands did. But they presented such an intense and focused vision of what psychedelic underground music could be like.
We're going to take a break, but as we go to break, we're going to listen to some more 13th floor elevators. The Kingdom of Heaven is Within You.
Yeah, that would be great.
That is the song Rain from the Beatles, and it is a psychedelic tune, an early psychedelic tune by the Fab Four. We're talking about psychedelic music with Professor William Eckert. His book is Psychedelic Popular Music, A History Through Music Topic Theory. And why is Rain, was this a watershed moment, no pun intended, for the Beatles?
Yeah, I mean, Rain was a lot of the techniques that people associate the Beatles with, the, you know, the tape experiments, the incorporation of some Indian music, the sort of trippy vocal double tracking. That was the first recording of theirs where a lot of that stuff came together on one record. And then it became even more widely noticed with things like Tomorrow Never Knows on Revolver and then Sgt. Pepper. But if you trace it back, Rain was one of the very earliest Beatles recordings that really found that sound.
And what do you call that sound? So how do you describe it?
Well, it's dreamlike. It's pop, but it's also got a certain kind of darkness and depth to it. Everything is a little bit unreal because of the way the voices have been sped up or slowed down or doubled.
But
at the same time, you know, it's recognizably the Beatles. It's recognizably a kind of a commercial, appealing form of pop music.
So it's a trippy, floaty sort of music style that if you were playing with recreational drugs at the time, that it could either enhance your trip or it could sort of invoke the trip that you took and remind you of the trip, your experience.
Yeah, and I think even more importantly, even people who aren't involved with the drugs, if they heard it, it would signify that to them, you know? I mean, the thing about people who are involved in those sorts of drugs is it's really unpredictable what's going to actually influence them one way or another. But some kinds of music came to culturally signify the idea of the drugs and the idea of a trip. And that sound was, you know, the sound that people came to associate with that.
So drugs and the music closely related. I guess Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which was coded for LSD, because if it were overtly talking about drugs, then it wouldn't get radio airplay. Is that what happened here?
That was a period when people weren't going to make drug references too overt. It was also a period when they were pushing the envelope, so kind of seeing what they could get away with.
And Lucy and the Sky with Diamonds, it was still trippy, but also playing around with imagery in the lyrics.
Yeah, very much. And this is where, you know, the drugs are important, but they're not everything. You know, the Beatles were drawing from a lot of influences at that time. You know, Bob Dylan and the influence of symbolist poetry was really important. The influence of all kinds of experimental art was really important. A lot of people at that time making psychedelic music were involved with drugs, but a lot weren't, right? So one thing that makes the time interesting was the way that the drug culture overlapped with these other kinds of experimentation, right? And it let people have all kinds of different ways into the music and into trying new things. Playing around with imagery, with wordplay, with sonic experiment. And then also in the case of the Beatles, right, the visual experiment with the films was really important.
Was a countercultural movement at the time. Drugs were in the forefront, you know, psychedelic music, psychedelic drugs, that was all out there, Timothy Leary. Wasn't this kind of shocking to have this part of a commercial pop culture?
I think for a lot of people it was, yeah. Although, you know, it was also the more reactionary elements of society were already scandalized by rock. I mean, you know, Elvis and the racial crossover had already made rock and roll threatening to a lot of people. And the associations sometimes that came again and went again between jazz and drugs were already on people's minds. So a lot of it was certainly, I don't know if it would have been shocking just so much as deepening that sense that rock music at that time was somewhat dangerous and countercultural and could represent some sort of an alternate vision of society. You know, it wasn't the first time that those sorts of ideas had been presented, but it might have been the moment where it got most intense for a lot of people.
But still, you had subcultural icons were pushing a rejection of traditional mom and dad square values. Drop In and Drop Out, or someone like Frank Zappa saying, who are the brain pools?
What will you do if we let you go home? And the plastic's all melted, and so is the chrome. Who are the brain police?
Oh yeah, I'm sure there would have been a lot of people who would have been shocked by it. The other thing too that I think is striking as though how relatively brief that period was, right? I mean, hindsight, you know, those sorts of really striking subcultural gestures start around 1965, 1966. By around 1969, you know, the whole thing had been so thoroughly corporatized and made mainstream that it had lost, you know, most of its oppositional power. So you're talking about a 5, maybe 6 year period when it might have had the potential to be really shocking to people, I think.
So even like bands that were considered to be sort of safe, like the Beach Boys, were playing around with psychedelic music as well.
Yep, yeah, very much so. And the Beach Boys are an interesting example, right, because they were really at the forefront for a period of time. You know, around the time of Pet Sounds and Good Vibrations and things like that, they were pretty much the most experimental outfit, certainly in terms of commercial pop.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
People don't think of Good Vibrations, I don't think, as a psychedelic song, really, even though when you set it aside and examine it, you go, yeah, it certainly is, but it still has that commercial feel to it.
Yeah, no, it has potential to be both, right? And that's why I was sort of saying earlier that the drug angle is important, but I think it's also really interesting how, you know, these songs can often serve double duty, right? For somebody who's coming from a more mainstream pop sensibility, there's nothing about that that would force you to hear it as psychedelic. But if you sit down and choose to listen to it as psychedelic, then there's some pretty obvious things in there, too.
Turning round with graceful motion, we're setting off with soft explosion, bound for a star with fiery ocean. It's so very lonely, you're 100 light.
That's the Rolling Stones, and that song is 2,000 Light Years from Home, 1967. It is their stab. The Rolling Stones always rolling into whatever is the popular form of the day, and at that time, it was psychedelic music. Psychedelic Popular Music is the name of the book that we're talking about with William Eckerd, and this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
600 light years from home.
They're now in, they're a psychedelic band now, you know, the Rolling Stones.
Took a shot at it anyway.
Yeah, but you hear a lot of the elements that, you know, it seemed like they, Mick Jagger is like, let me grab a little bit of this, a little bit of that, the recipe in front of me.
Right.
A song about space, some trippy guitar work, a lot of echoey and sort of a change up in texture throughout the music. Are these is that the formula for a psychedelic tune?
Yeah, it's certainly one of them. The Stones hit on I think it may be even a more important psychedelic gesture for them with Painted Black, right, the year before, which is another sort of template, right, the sort of really hard-driving rave-up kind of sound. One thing that makes 2,000 Light Years from Home really interesting is that it's also a space rock tune, right? I mean, the Stones got criticized by a lot of people at that time because there was this feeling they were jumping on the bandwagon. Like you're saying, a lot of the psychedelic elements in that song were already in place from other people. But if you look at it as a space rock song, it makes it a little bit more ahead of the curve because there weren't a lot of other people specifically exploring that aspect of psychedelia, right? When you really make things very spacious and you have the sort of the mellotrons and the more synthetic sounds and all the echo, and that direction that obviously bands like Pink Floyd specialized in more. So, you know, the Stones, you want to give them credit for the fact that, at least in that particular tune, they were aware of that potential in the psychedelic sound. you know, and that song was important partly for pushing in that direction.
It's so very lonely. You're 2,000 light years from home.
The Byrds, they were pioneers in psychedelic music?
Oh, yeah, I would say very much so. A couple of different ways, right?
Yeah.
You know, in pushing the connection between psychedelic music and folk music, which wasn't the predominant thing. Like, a lot of people think of psychedelic music as in terms of soul or funk or rock. But folk has always been important, and so the Byrds were part of that. They were really important for doing some of the most psychedelic versions of ragga rock with things like 8 Miles High. And also with jazz, you know. I mean, another thing that makes 8 Miles High in particular important was it's got these obvious borrowings from John Coltrane. And so creating that sense that although there might be some affinity between jazz and psychedelic music, you know, they were pioneers in that area too.
8 miles high, and when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known. Signs in the street that say,
In your book, you break down the elements of psychedelic music. And so what do you see as the most dominant aspects of a psychedelic rock song?
I guess if you're going to look at the middle period, like sort of setting aside the more garagey, ragga, psychedelic pop, and look at things more in the nature of, you know, 1967, later, the later 60s, a lot of experimentation, longer songs, drones, a lot of improvisation and extended solos, a lot of effects, echoes, reverberation.
So like Eric Burdon and the Animals with the Sky Pilot.
Yeah, I mean, that's another good example.
He blesses the boys as they stand in line. The smell of gun grease and their bayonets, they shine. He's there to help them all that he can. To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man.
The thing is that, you know, it's tricky because a lot of those features you can find in songs that aren't so psychedelic, right? So it's always subtle in any particular. It almost works better to listen to a particular song and ask, you know, why would this song seem psychedelic? When you try and generalize, it gets harder and harder to come up with one thing that they're all going to have in common.
Yeah, but we all put them under that same umbrella and we call them psychedelic music for some reason.
Yeah, we do. And I think what's interesting is you'll do it for different reasons with different artists, right? Like, if you think of a group like the Incredible String Band, to go someone who sounds really very different from everybody we've been talking to up until now, it's going to be psychedelic partly because of context, right? Because they're coming from a communal kind of hippie background, because of all the dream imagery and the sort of childhood imagery in the lyrics, because of the sort of experimental, quirky nature of the way they arrange folk music. But they sound nothing like the 13th Elevators, or they don't sound much like the Beatles or things. So, you know, it's always, I think with different artists, there'll be different reasons to consider them to be psychedelic.
Oh, seekers of spring, How could you not find contentment in a time of riddling reasons in this land of the blind? By the joke of fate alone, it's sure that as the loved hand leaves you, you clutch for the slipstream, the realness to find. Till you die, my poor little man. For Jesus will stretch out his hand no more.
Jefferson Airplane, you know, with their tune White Rabbit. That seems right. to be a song that is about indulging in drugs.
It is, but it's also, yeah, it certainly is a song that illustrates. I mean, one thing that makes that song really interesting is the way that it forms that constant sort of arc, you know, the starting quiet and the just building and building and building and building and building to the peak. So it's got the lyrics and it's got all the sort of the trippy guitars, but it also just has that really striking form that kind of gives this sense of, you know, entering into a drug trip, the drug taking hold of you kind of thing. But it's also about childhood, right? It's also about children's literature and that perspective.
One pill makes you larger and one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. And if you go chasing rabbits and you know has given you the call Alice when she was just small. One man on the chessboard, get up and tell you where to go, and you just had some kind of mushroom and your mind is moving on.
One thing that's interesting about all these songs is none of them are just drug songs. They're always, you know, much earlier you were talking about how people would hide their drug references or try not to be obvious about them. And so one way they would do that is they would find lyrical ideas or sonic ideas which were from something else, from children's literature or from Indian classical music or from experimental electronic music. But when you express the drug culture or talk about the drug culture through those other ideas, then the song is also about those other things, right? So it's never just about the drug culture. It's always about childhood literature or exoticism or these, you know. And then you get these complicated ways that interacts with the drug culture and makes, you know, all these different levels of meaning.
But there was also the rejection of the war culture. We mentioned Sky Pilot, but there were other songs. you know, that could be seen as an anti-war, and were used in the culture as they fought against war as through protest.
Right. Yeah, very much so. Well, again, you know, one criticism that gets made, one thing that's interesting is that one striking example is Country Joe and the Fish, right? Because they had some really obvious anti-war material, and they had some really obvious psychedelic things, but often not the same song, right? I mean, a lot of those bands, when they were writing the more psychedelic material, it would be less politically specific. You know, at the time, people would criticize it even as escapist. But because it was part of an oppositional culture, you know, the same band might do a really political anti-war song as well as this more trippy, vague song. You know, the psychedelic style and the protest style were related to each other.
So let's hear Country Joe and the Fish, section 43. Another quick break. When we return, psychedelic meets funk on The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. That is Sly and the Family Stone, Trip to Your Heart, released in 1967, and it is part of the funkadelic movement that we picked up on the psychedelic scene. We're talking about psychedelic popular music. That's the book written by William Eckert, and we're playing some cuts and talking about this music and trying to figure out where it came from and where it's going, because it is still part of the scene today. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio.
You like diamonds? I got diamonds!
So when we talk about Sly and the Family Stone and Trip Your Heart, what should we make of it?
Well, you know, what at the time, maybe you know, the most important thing was that it was soul music. It was funk music. You know, one thing that's unfortunate about psychedelic music is that people talk a lot about how rock and roll began as a fusion of blacker and whiter styles of music, right? Country and R&B with rockabilly. And that was a huge part of what made the music socially and musically important in the 50s. By the later 60s, rock music and funk soul music, you know, were subdividing more. This idea of, you know, racially dividing the audience and black music versus white music was reasserting itself to a certain extent. And a lot of psychedelic music was all, not all of it, but a lot of it was also in the psychedelic rock, was music that had minimized the obvious African-American elements. You know, the blues elements were there, but less so. Soul and R&B elements, not so evident. So it was really significant in the long run that there were also these psychedelic soul funk bands, because they showed that even though a group like the Beatles or even the Grateful Dead might have been drifting further and further from an African-American influence, that in a bigger sense, you know, these psychedelic ideas and this sort of experimentation also were finding expression in areas like soul and funk. In the very long run, that's important because of the way that got put back together in the 1980s and 1990s, right, with rave culture and with rock-rave crossovers, and where that kind of, you know, racial division of the music also then started to get people had started to get past that, and you saw more fusions then of rock and funk and things like that.
Was it a conscious decision to say, we're going to take on these attributes of psychedelic music and put them into our funk show, or is it this is what the audience was clamoring for? I mean, how does this all come about?
I think it was both. I mean, I know that in the case of George Clinton, he talked on occasion about being very conscious about looking at somebody like Hendrix, a more psychedelic artist, and thinking, okay, we can take elements of that and put it into our funk music. With Sly Stone, you know, my impression is that it might have been more just a matter of being from the area, from the sort of, you know, Bay Area, having an inclusive sort of attitude, right? I mean, a lot of those funk artists, you see it also when you look at Otis Redding performing at Monterey, right? Not a particularly psychedelic artist, but having this attitude of trying to include everybody, trying to create a music that's going to respond to whatever's happening around. So I think with Sly, it was, you know, especially because most people start the psychedelic funk story with Sly Stone. I don't get the impression it's particularly calculated, just so much as these are all the things that are happening around right now. How can we make a kind of music that's going to respond to all of this and try and include all of it? George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic come along a little later, right? So the music had become a little more self-conscious about its own history.
Well, sure.
So, yeah. But so, even there, it was, you know, I think the notion of inclusiveness, right? And that's something that the funk people and the more hippie rock people had in common. Both of those subcultures at the time were interested in how can we draw people in? How can we make a music that tries to speak to a lot of different kinds of people?
Here's Parliament, Dr. Funkenstein.
Whoa! They say the bigger the headache, the bigger the pill, baby. Call me the big pill. Dr. Funkenstein, the disco fiend with the monster sound, the cool goo with the bum transplant.
Hip bone connected to my thigh bone connected to my leg bone connected to my ankle bone.
I get so hung up on bones. Dr. Funkenstein here.
Preoccupied and dedicated to the preservation of the motion of hips.
We love you, from you, Funkenstein. Your funk is the best.
Talk!
Take my body and give it to mine. Do it all with the rest.
Kiss me on my ego.
Hit me with the one and then. If you like, hit me again. We love you, Funkenstein.
Dr. Funkenstein. King of the funk, yeah.
Swift lipping, ego tripping, and body snatching. From the mothership, pulling up the last leg of the feet pump.
Simultaneously as Parliament and Sly and the Family Stone are going their way, bringing psychedelic music into funk music, we have the Grateful Dead out there producing their own trippy psychedelic music, free form, a lot of long improvisational music, finding themselves their own lane to play in.
Very much so. And keeping alive, you know, the connections with folk music and country music, which was always a sort of an important minority stream in psychedelic music.
But the Grateful Dead, they were very conscious of that they were a psychotropic band, that they didn't see themselves actually as playing the music for the concert, that the show was actually the people who were attending the concert. They were actually providing the soundtrack for the show of the people.
Yeah. And, you know, the Grateful Dead always, I think, were maybe one of the best examples of a group that emerged from the Haight-Ashbury scene that saw themselves as an extension of the community, at least in, you know, while that community existed. Because even before they were the Grateful Dead, as the Warlocks, you know, starting playing for the acid tests, the early acid tests. So there was always that sense with the Grateful Dead that the band was one of the things that was happening in the larger community, rather than separating itself out as, you know, as a distinct entity.
This is the Grateful Dead, Box of Rain.
Sky.
So when we have bands today, like MGMT, looking at psychedelic influences and cherry-picking things and bringing them forward to today,
right.
That's a deliberate decision. They're trying to what? What is it about psychedelic music that they that you think that they are trying to bring back?
A couple things happen as a style of music gets older. One thing that happens is it becomes more and more of a style. And what I mean by that is, you know, in the 60s, when the psychedelic music was a new thing in terms of how it sounded, and psychedelic cultures were a new thing as a kind of a social phenomenon, you know, it wasn't so much about style as it was about experimentation. There, you know, the style hadn't solidified yet. But then over time, people get expectations of what psychedelic music is supposed to sound like. You know, it becomes a series of particular sounds or particular visual styles, just like film noir or the blues or country music or any of these more, you know, it becomes a set of stereotypes almost. You know, so one thing that happens in later periods is artists who like to play around with imagery, who like to play around with established styles and stereotypes, psychedelia becomes one more set of options in that vocabulary. The other thing that happens, though, is you get people who feel that they have a commitment to the lifestyle. And I don't just mean necessarily drugs, but to a sense of a countercultural, communal, experimental, you know, these values that psychedelia represented as a way of life. And so you also get people who are attracted to that and who are trying to enact a set of possibilities for living. And you get artists all along the whole spectrum. You know, for some people, it's a matter of playing around with stylistic cliches, just because that's interesting and it lets you do a lot of interesting things stylistically. And then all the way to people who are trying to, you know, like the rave culture of the later 80s and early 90s, where they're really trying to keep the countercultural lifestyle alive.
We've been speaking with William Eckert. He's a professor of music at Carleton University, Ottawa. He's the author of the book Psychedelic Popular Music, A History Through Musical Topic Theory. And we're going to go out listening to some MGMT. This is Electric Feel. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.